Diane. Great to be back with you on My Mind This Week.
Hi, I'm Bill O'Reilly. Thanks for watching us tonight. The Trump surveillance
new revelations about multiple payouts to women alleging sexual harassment by Fox News superstar Bill O'Reilly.
He is a huge profit center for them, and you don't fire someone like that easily. But the question is, when do you fire someone like that?
Paul Farhi at The Washington Post is covering this story. He tells me what seems to be going on. Then David Rothkopf of the FP Group, which produces Foreign Policy magazine.
We've been seeing a transformation on the planet that's really unprecedented. And that is the move towards, for the first time in human history, having every human being on the planet connected in a man-made system.
He describes how technology is on the verge of totally upending our way of life. He details the basic questions we need to be asking ourselves to get a better grasp on the sweeping revolution ahead. Paul, it's good to see you.
And great to see you.
First, Paul Farhi of The Washington Post. What is going on at Fox?
I think Fox would like to get to the bottom of it, too. There are multiple, or have been multiple, sexual harassment allegations against Roger Ailes, the co-founder of Fox News, and Bill O'Reilly, the biggest star at Fox News. Now, they thought they had this behind them. They thought they had purged Roger Ailes and gotten the sexual harassment scandal behind them, but they clearly have not. A new one came out from an on-air contributor who accused Roger Ailes and the current president, his successor, Bill Shine, of both sexual harassment by Roger Ailes and retaliation by Bill Shine. So it continues.
Thus far, as I understand it, the lawsuits have finally paid out some $13 million. Bill O'Reilly himself makes $18 million per year. His contributors total some $442 million that his program makes in a year. So $13 million payout is a drop in the bucket.
Well, you have to separate out these things. $13 million is just the number of the Bill O'Reilly settlements. There are other settlements here involving Roger Ailes. Think about two tracks. Both of them have been accused widely of sexual harassment of female employees at Fox News. And Fox News has paid out an unknown number of millions of dollars in addition to the $13 million that we know Bill O'Reilly has paid out. Now, all of this is important to know in terms of the accounting because there's an investigation underway by the U.S. attorney in New York about whether Fox adequately disclosed these payments, at least in the Roger Ailes cases, to its shareholders. They are responsible as a public company, part of a public company, 21st Century Fox, to disclose material financial events. Several million dollars of payouts for sexual harassment is a material financial event. And that's what the Attorney General in New York is investigating right now. Did they make adequate disclosure?
How could they avoid making adequate disclosure when all of this was in the newspaper?
Well, all of it wasn't in the newspaper until it got into the newspaper. A lot of it happened behind closed doors, in closed settlements, and people were issued checks and they walked away. A lot of it came tumbling out after the fact, particularly the triggering moment when Gretchen Carlson, one of the hosts at Fox and Friends, the morning show, filed her lawsuit, which was now July 6th of last year. So she filed it and then all of these skeletons started tumbling out. Payments and investigations and millions of dollars changing hands between the accuser and the accused. And it continues to come out. So we are still not at the bottom of this, and we still don't have a really good accounting of this. And remember, Fox News is a news organization. They perhaps have some disclosure responsibilities about what's going on in their own house. They could do a little bit of reporting to find out what's going on within their own house, and they haven't to date. All of the revelations have come from other sources, including, I might add, the Washington Post.
And despite all of this, Fox and Fox News remains the number one watched channel?
Oh, by far. They're not just the number one news channel on cable television. They are the number one cable channel. Now, let's put that in a little bit of perspective. During the first quarter of this year, they achieved a record high average viewer rating, put them number one among cable networks. But let's look at that number. It's, 1.7 million at any time during the day. 1.7 million people are watching Fox News at any point during the day.
Compared to CNN?
Compared to CNN, which much lower, I think under a million, perhaps maybe a little bit over a million. But these are relatively low numbers. Cable is not a broad reach medium for the most part. You have national distribution to 300 million potential viewers. And at any time, you're getting 1.7. But listen, it's all relative. You, as a cable network, sell on your average ratings. Fox News is an enormous profit center for 21st Century Fox, the parent company, over $1.5 billion in profit last year. CNN is also enormously profitable, too. Bill O'Reilly, the biggest star on Fox News, if he gets 3.5 million viewers a night, that's a big deal. Of course, that would get him canceled on a broadcast network. But again, it's a different standard. It's cable ratings versus everybody else's ratings.
So considering the number of lawsuits against Bill O'Reilly and the $13 million paid out just for his lawsuits, why hasn't he been fired?
He is too big to fire. He is an enormous profit center. Of that $1.5 billion, I'm sure O'Reilly accounts for a rather large percentage of it. He is the number one star, not just on Fox, but on cable news. There is no personality bigger on cable news. He is a huge profit center for them. And you don't fire someone like that easily. But the question is, when do you fire someone like that? These lawsuits and these allegations go back to 2002. And again, these are the ones we know about. There may be others that have been kept secret. A lot of the women who have filed these were under gag orders. It was only because of the digging of the New York Times and a few other outlets that we do know about some of these. So we don't know the extent of it, but the extent that we do know looks pretty bad. Anybody else with five allegations costing $13 million against them would have been out the door before the number reached five.
So there remains this very close connection between President Trump and Fox News. Can you talk about that?
Yes, this goes back a long way. Fox News was founded in 1996, became the network of the conservative viewer. Donald Trump, who's no fool, became friends with Roger Ailes very early on and became friends with Rupert Murdoch, who is the chairman of Fox News and the chairman of the parent company as well. They are tied together. When Roger Ailes was forced out of Fox News last summer as a result of the sexual harassment allegations, he became an informal advisor to Donald Trump's campaign. We don't know the extent of the advice he gave, but he was close to Trump. Where this all kind of intersects is at the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General, looking into these payments, looking into the disclosure issue of whether the 21st Century Fox and Fox News adequately disclosed all of the sexual harassment settlements, is whether or not the Trump administration is going to perhaps put its thumb on the scale of that investigation to help out a couple of old friends of his. Now, we have no indication that that is the case right now, but that is the potential of this. Can this investigation continue on to its logical conclusion, whatever that might be, without any interference from the Trump administration, who might be tempted, let's just say, to help out an old friend?
And what about the relationship between President Trump's tweeting and Fox News reporting?
Well, now that's a separate issue, separate from the sexual harassment allegations and this investigation at the Attorney General's office. The interplay between Trump and Fox News is a fascinating story. If you look at the history of Trump's tweets, going back before he was elected, you will see a very clear and striking pattern. What is said on particularly a program called Fox and Friends, the morning show, tends to feed what Trump says in his tweets. So it is clear that he is watching Fox and Friends, hearing something that he likes, and then going to his computer or his phone and tweeting it out. And you saw this, and you continue to see this periodically. So he appears to get a lot of his talking points from Fox News. Now, I'd say it's a two-way street. I think Fox News, in many ways, gets their talking points from Trump. And so it goes round and round. And it's a, I don't want to say virtuous circle, but it's a circle. One leads to the other, leads to the other, leads to the other.
At the same time, is he communicating with his base through Fox News?
Most certainly. He's reinforcing his own positions. He's using Fox to reinforce his positions. And by tweeting these things out, he is speaking, well, he's speaking to everyone, of course, but I think the message probably resonates most strongly among the people who support him. Now, that's a declining number of people, but there are people who live within the bubble of Fox News, who support President Trump to the end, believe what he says, believe what Fox says. Listen, I mean, it isn't to say that what Fox News reports is wrong. It's just that if you get your information from one place, you are a captive of whatever that one place wants to tell you about. I trust the Washington Post, having worked for it for a long time, but I don't think it's the only source in the world for information. There are numerous sources. And this circle that Trump has created creates a kind of bubble, I think, a silo in which people can live within without any outside information causing them to rethink what they are hearing.
All right. But as you've said, you've got the U.S. Attorney's Office in New York. You may have the Attorney General here in Washington, D.C., taking a look at all this. Where do you see Fox News and Fox News Channel, considering everything that's happened, a year from now?
I don't know is the honest answer, but here's my guess. They will be more or less exactly the same as they are now. And the reason I say this is, one, because Fox News just re-signed Bill O'Reilly, despite knowledge of all the settlements and the allegations against him, to a new contract. So he's going to be on the air at least till 2020. He is their tentpole, their franchise, around which the entire network revolves.
Let me interrupt you. Suppose, even having signed that new contract, more women were to come forward. Is there a way that perhaps the upper echelon might say, well, maybe this has gotten too risky, more risky than he's worth?
Yes, I think that is possible. And I stress the word possible because, again, I don't know. And we can judge maybe based on history. Okay, so the best history here is Roger Ailes. Roger Ailes was the founder, the co-founder with Rupert Murdoch of Fox News, lasted 20 years, built it into this enormous profit center for Rupert Murdoch and 20 News Corp, but the successor company, 21st Century Fox. The allegations against him go back preceding that to the 1960s, and Fox News and his parent company did everything they could to ignore these allegations for a very long time until it became absolutely untenable. That is, 21st Century Fox brought in a law firm to investigate Fox News when Gretchen Carlson filed her lawsuit in July of last year. They found a series of allegations by employees at Fox News until such time as they could not stand by Roger Ailes anymore, despite all the years of rumor and allegation and suggestion. And finally, they had to say, within 3 weeks of Gretchen Carlson's lawsuit, we can't stand for this. Now, this is apparently the result of not Rupert Murdoch's direction, but the direction of his sons. His sons are actually the chief executives and top executives at the parent company. Rupert, their dad, is the chairman. They are the CEOs of 21st Century Fox. They are the ones who decided they wanted to make a clean breast of it. They didn't have any love for Roger Ailes. They didn't owe him in the same way that dad did. And so they apparently, we don't know exactly, but they apparently made the call to say, Roger, it's been a great 20 years. Thanks very much. Here's $40 million. Please now go away and we will change the leadership of Fox News. So things did get bad enough with Roger Ailes. Now, have things gotten bad enough with Bill O'Reilly? That remains to be seen.
I want to tell you about something I heard on the BBC News this morning. The correspondent was speaking with a representative of the Syrian government about gassing and the death of many children as a result. And the Syrian representative used the phrase, that's fake yes. news. And I found myself thinking, my God, from the president of the United States' mouth now to those speaking in Syria. That phrase, fake news.
Well, this is one of the most unfortunate elements of the last presidential campaign, the abuse and overuse of the term fake news. You can define it any way you want, but it has been stretched and pushed and pulled in every direction to mean basically anything I don't like hearing is fake news to me. It may be fact, it may not be fact, but I don't like it, and to dismiss it without any further debate, I'm going to call it fake news. This is undermining not just news reporting, but reality. We have gotten to the point where we can't agree on not just the facts. You have your set of facts, I have my set of facts, but what is a fact? And everyone has a vested interest, and everyone pulls out this term fake news to dismiss the other side or dismiss information that they just don't like. And it's really, really sad because we're losing any sense of connection to what might actually be true and what is simply your propaganda.
So you tell me how you discern what is fake news from real news.
Well, that's what reporters do all day. The job of a reporter is to find out things from credible sources, double check them with other credible sources to verify them, and to put them in a context that makes sense. You have to know the history of an event. You have to know the background of the people involved. You have to be able to weigh various conflicting bits of information to discern what is and what is not the case.
And my fear is that fewer and fewer people are willing to take the time to do that.
They are because they can live in this bubble in which they receive information from just one source that disputes all the other sources that are telling them something to the contrary. And as long as you hold fast to one source, no matter how credible or not, you'll never get an awareness of the totality of information that's out there. Look, we have more information available to us more easily than ever, and that's both a boon and a bane. You have good information from credible sources, and you have lots and lots of bad information. Fake news, in the strictest definition, is a bunch of people somewhere just making up stuff. No attempt to verify, no attempt to report, no attempt to double check, but just making up stuff for what purpose? Making money? Causing mischief? Undermining reality? That's what fake news is to me.
Finally, I was in Philadelphia recently speaking to a group of young college students. And what is happening there is that they are teaching a class on how to discern real news from fake news. Maybe that will go on in colleges around the country.
Efforts like that are very valuable, and they go back some ways, but they are more important than ever. This is sometimes called media literacy, and I just want to mention that Facebook and a number of other organizations just put about $14 million into a program at City University of New York to develop some kind of media literacy curricula, events to promote media literacy among people. Now, listen, I don't think that you're going to educate hundreds of millions of people in the precise way to discern what is and what is not fact. Because the fact is even credible organizations get things wrong. The difference is credible organizations correct the record. They tell you when they got things wrong, whereas the fake news organizations, the fakers, do not. And they don't care because, let's face it, they're putting out fake news and they know it.
Paul Fahey, it's always good to see you and to talk with you.
Likewise. Thank you.
Thank you. And now a quick break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
And we're back. David Rothkopf, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be here.
From a studio at Columbia University, David Rothkopf, CEO and editor of Foreign Policy Magazine. You know, in your new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow, you talk about a major change that's coming. What is it that you see?
Well, I talk about the fact that while we have devoted our attention for the past 15 years to issues like terrorism or our own domestic politics or the headlines of the moment, we've been seeing a transformation on the planet that's really unprecedented. And that is the move towards, within a few years from now, for the first time in human history, having every human being on the planet connected in a man-made system. That's the internet. It's thanks to smartphones. But essentially what it does is it creates a single global cultural, political, and economic ecosystem. And that really has to force us to ask a lot of big fundamental questions because it produces the kind of change that we see not, you know, once every 10 years or 20 years like some of these headlines we're talking about, but really once every 300, 400, 500 years in human history, an epochal change.
Here's one portion of a paragraph of your book that really got to me. You say, in the whole history of humanity, there has never been a moment when our species did not possess the most powerful intellectual capacity on our little planet. That is a distinction that is not likely to survive this century. What do you mean?
Well, it means that subsequent to this change to a connected world, we're also going to be entering a change to an artificially intelligence-enhanced or perhaps powered world. That means that if you talk to the leading computer science specialists out there, you talk to the leading technologists out there, all of them will tell you that within 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, we are going to have machines that are as smart or smarter than people. And this is also a game changer of the most profound sort, because it raises questions about how we should empower those machines, how we should limit those machines, how those machines will be regulated, how those machines might regulate us. And, you know, a lot of very, very prominent people, from Stephen Hawking to Bill Gates, you know, have gathered together and said, hey, folks, wake up. This is a change you're not prepared for, and it could have consequences for how we're governed, how we fight wars, how we conduct business, who does business, where economic activity is driven. Really, really, really profound and philosophically challenging developments.
Can you share with us Elon Musk's dire warnings with respect to artificial intelligence?
Well, he's part of that group, and all of them are concerned that what we are going to see is inevitably people pushing computer capacity to the point where the smartest brain in the room may not be a human brain. And that at that moment when the human being can be outsmarted, the question becomes, who's in charge? Is it the human or the machine? Or consider the possibility that at some point the CEO of a company might say, you know, I don't want to take a risk. I know I can trust this computer to make decisions better than a person. I'm going to put this computer in charge of a group of people, and it will guide them. And we've already, you know, started to see that to some extent. I think you may have seen some of the articles about Uber recently. And this is very, very crude, low-level examples of this. But you've got apps that are kind of shaping the management of a fleet of human drivers.
On the other hand, if you did have that much artificial intelligence at work, might it not address one of the problems you spoke of earlier, that we're always reacting to what happens? For example, a shoe bomber, for example, something left in a trash can, and then we're examining all the trash cans, but it's too late. Couldn't artificial intelligence help us move forward rather than simply looking backward?
Of course it could, and that's why we'll have it, because the arc of history moves in the direction of progress, and it tends to be a net good, but it almost never comes without complications or philosophical challenges. And I raise the term philosophical because we don't usually talk about that. It seems abstract, particularly in policy communities or business communities. It's like, well, I don't have time for that stuff. But we're getting to the point where certain questions have to be asked again. And this happens whenever we have these big once in every 500 years epochal changes in society. Things like, who am I? If we gain our identity from the community we're in, and we're moving from a geographically defined community to a virtual community, that's important. Or who am I if I sort of view myself in the context of human achievement, and all of a sudden I find myself in a world in which machine achievement may outstrip human achievement? That's a critical question. What kind of rights do we give to each other? Do you have a right to access the internet? That might have seemed extreme 20 years ago when it was something new, but you can't today be a citizen without having access to the internet. You can't get an education. You can't conduct yourself economically. You can't conduct yourself politically. And there are already 9 or 10 countries in the world where having internet access is a human right. And the same thing holds true for artificial intelligence. Imagine a world in which a computer has a lot of the qualities of a human being. Does it have any rights? Does it have any obligations? Does its creator have any rights? Can you turn it off? You know, that sounds kind of crazy, right? But if we start moving down this road, we need to have these questions. And one of the things that I find from my time in Washington or my time out and dealing with businesses is people tend not to have the time, they think, to ask the fundamental philosophical questions. Who am I? What is government? What is the social contract? What is war? What is peace? What is money? What is a job? And yet we're hurtling towards a period in which the answers to all of those questions are different from what they have been in the past.
You also talk about the fact that very few members of Congress have any understanding of technology or science. What is that going to mean going forward?
Well, it means that the people who are making the laws or the people who are determining national policies are not actually going to understand the forces that are at work changing our society, changing international relations, governing our security, governing our economics. Things like the old way we looked at economic policy, where we sort of said we have two tools, fiscal tools and monetary tools, are going to change. Because all of a sudden, we're going to have real-time data in this big data world from 30, 40, 50 billion devices on the internet that'll give us a real picture of all the economic activity that is taking place on a city block or in a house or in a family in real time. And we will then all of a sudden begin to see correlations between individuals and companies and small places in the world that are going to be completely different from what we've seen in the past. And we might say, you know, it doesn't make sense to come up with national economic policies because the correlations are weak. We should come up with, you know, imagine a country called Dianistan. And in Dianistan, there are 10 million people who really are very much like you. And we might come up with stimuli for the economy of Dianistan that work completely differently than it would for Davidstan or some other grouping in our society. This requires us to rethink the underpinnings of economics in ways we are not doing it.
And another paragraph from your book, you say, we must ask in the world of the future, where will the real power lie? Is the era of the predominance of the nation state drawing to a close? Talk about what you mean by the nation state and how you see that changing.
Well, you know, we have a tendency to assume that things that have existed for a couple of hundred years have always existed. But of course, the nation state was born around the time of the Treaty of Westphalia, around the time of the Thirty Years' War, at the end of the Reformation, when we moved from an era of principalities and fiefdoms and the feudal era into a period in which nations had sovereignty over a fairly large piece of land. They were the primary actors on the global stage, and we conducted international relations on a nation-state-to-nation-state basis. But today, there are large groups of people who have more affinity to people around the world beyond borders than they do to their neighbors. And so they might group themselves as communities. And also many of the powers that once were limited to nation states, whether it's the power to wage a war or to bring down the economy of a nation state or to stop the politics of a nation state, are now accruing to people with strong technological capabilities. And we've seen this. We've seen small individual actors with very crude technologies do what we once only thought nation states could do. That happened on 9/11 when a handful of people destroyed a significant portion of lower Manhattan and dealt a blow to the U.S. economy that we never thought that a group of independent actors could do. But imagine a world in which some people have access to superpowered artificial intelligence, cyber capabilities, the ability to turn out the lights or to shut down the rail activity or the air traffic activity in a country. That doesn't require a nation state. That requires a small actor. But that actor will have a huge amount of power. And similarly, we may change the way governance works and move more towards e-democracies. And e-democracies may lead towards different kind of referenda. And we've seen, you know, with Brexit, Britain pulling out of the EU, and that was one referendum. But what if that became more common and people could reconstitute themselves or regroup themselves on a much more regular basis, and government could be more fluid and flexible. That might be good in some ways, but it also might be a very unstable world that was very emotionally driven as opposed to intellectually driven.
So, David, who out there is asking the right questions? And that is what you say is deficient. We're not asking the right questions. Who's going to do that?
First of all, in a democracy, it's beholden to the citizenry to start asking the right questions. And part of the thought behind this book is to frame in a brief way some of those questions, or at least seed the cloud so people can come up with their own questions. Of course, there are people out there, there are philosophers like Nick Bostrom who are dealing with the issue of artificial intelligence, or there are people like Elon Musk and others that you've referred to. I referred to Stephen Hawking or Bill Gates and others who are starting to ask the questions about artificial intelligence. There are a few people in the world of governance that are asking the questions of what the future of governance will look like, and it's not all in the United States. You know, every year in the United Arab Emirates, they have a governance summit, and they talk about what technologically empowered governance will look like. And, you know, that's a country where when a cabinet minister gets their job, they also get an iPad. And on their iPad is a ranking of all the other cabinet ministers in real time in terms of their performance.
Huh.
And so the government is sort of saying, here's the dashboard of who's succeeding and who's not succeeding in advancing the government's agenda. And if you're in the bottom couple of people on this list, you've got a problem. Well, that's kind of interesting. They're asking some interesting questions out there. And, of course, in China and Asia, you see the same thing as well.
But doesn't that also create a tremendous amount of fear, not only about how you're ranked or where you stand, but also about how you take the very next step?
Sure. I think a lot of the things that I'm talking about here create a lot of fear. People are used to having money in their pocket, and they won't have money in their pocket. People are used to the success of the Cold War, where the price of fighting a war was so high that we didn't dare fight one. And now we're moving into an era of cool war, of cyber conflict, where the price of fighting a war is so low because it's so hard to detect who's doing it, that perhaps we don't dare stop. And it might be that this new era is actually more dangerous and raises tensions more than the other. We're entering unknown territory with artificial intelligence. We're entering unknown territory with new forms of governance. And I think that one of the reasons that we have actually not stared these problems in the eye, beyond not having the right questions, is that we fear these changes. But that's not going to stop them. All it's going to do is produce backlash. And, you know, I think we live in a period right now where you look at people like Donald Trump or Vladimir Putin or right-wingers in Europe or Bibi Netanyahu in Israel, and these are all reactionaries. These are all people saying, gee, I wish it was more like the 20th century. I wish it was more like the world I'm comfortable with. If only we could forestall the changes that are coming. What I see is that this is a common historical phenomenon, but sooner or later, new leaders emerge to harness the power of the coming changes. And the question is whether those will be used leaders who do it for good or for bad.
And David, right now, I'm really, really worried about North Korea. It would seem, I know that President Trump is meeting with the Chinese leader. The question becomes, to what extent is China going to help with North Korea, or are they going to keep hands off? And at the same time, you have a leader in North Korea, Kim Jong-un, who is threatening not only South Korea, but the coast of Japan, and indeed threatening the west coast of the United States.
Well, I think we should be worried about North Korea, and I think there's several reasons. You know, Bill Clinton once joked that nuclear weapons were North Korea's only cash crop. And what he meant was that they could rattle their saber and the world would say, oh, please stop, and they would send them wheat or they would send them whatever they needed to fix their deeply dysfunctional system.
Seems different now.
Well, I think it is different now, and I think it is orders of magnitude more serious, and I think it's made more serious still by the fact that the president of the United States is both extremely inexperienced and given to bluster, and he has not figured out the importance of working well with our allies and potential partners in this area. The meeting that he's having with Xi Jinping, this will clearly be high on the agenda. The question is whether the president will have the deftness to recognize that this is an important issue on which we cannot achieve our goals without the Chinese, or he will, for political reasons, pound the Chinese on some trade issues, alienate them, make it harder to have their cooperation. But I can say one thing, and that is, first of all, North Korea is exploring how these new technologies can empower them. And the Sony hack a couple of years ago, where they destroyed a lot of computers inside a film company in order to suppress the release of a film that they felt was offensive, was kind of pioneering work. And it shows the power of a small country like that to attack the United States via cyber and not really bear heavy consequences for it. And secondly, the Chinese also have a much longer view of these things and are certainly asking questions about the nature and the balance of power, not just today, but in the future. And I think that tends to guide them to be more strategic about questions like North Korea than we are with a guy like Trump, who tends to be more tactical.
So how do you think all this is going to work out? I really repeat, I am worried because Secretary of State Tillerson has simply said something to the effect that all options are on the table. Are we headed for some kind of nuclear confrontation with North Korea?
What I worry about is not that we end up in a nuclear war because the U.S. decides we're going to go and launch a nuclear first strike on North Korea, or the other way around. What I worry about is that we ratchet up tensions and then there is an accident. And the fact that the leader of North Korea and the leader of the United States are people who are impulsive leads to an escalation. That, to me, I think, is one of the greatest risks we face in the world today. And frankly, it is in that scenario that I see the Chinese as a potentially stabilizing force, because they're the ones who have the most to lose from a conflict like that regionally. Of course, the South Koreans would be at great risk. But in terms of the major power players, the Chinese, I think, are more likely to play a stabilizing role, whereas the North Koreans and potentially Trump are likely to be forces for escalation or greater tension.
David Rothkopf, his new book, The Great Questions of Tomorrow. David, thanks for joining me.
Always a pleasure, Diane.
Thank you. And for this week from the archives, we've been hearing a lot about partisan rancor in the Senate over the nomination of Judge Neil Gorsuch to the Supreme Court.
We need to restore the norms and traditions of the Senate and get past this unprecedented partisan filibuster. Therefore, I raise a point of order that the vote on cloture under the precedent set on November 21st, 2013, is a majority vote on all nominations.
In 2013, tables were turned. Democrats, frustrated by Republican intransigence over President Obama's nominees, voted to end filibusters for executive branch and lower court nominees. The concern then was that it would be a slippery slope with possible filibuster rule changes for Supreme Court nominees and major legislation as well. In July of 2013, a panel joined me to talk about the political situation leading up to Majority Leader Harry Reid's decision to choose the so-called nuclear option. But first, Senator Bernie Sanders weighed in.
Well, I think everybody recognizes, Diane, that our country faces enormous problems right now. We're looking at a middle class that is collapsing, gap between the rich and the poor, growing wider. We're not addressing the great planetary issue of global warming. Real unemployment is over 14%. So everybody sees these issues, and they're looking at the U.S. Senate, and they're saying, what are you doing about it? What actions are you taking? And what people do not understand is that we're not having real debates on the real issues impacting the American people, because time after time after time, the Republicans are using unprecedented obstructionist tactics. Now, here's the main point to be made. The Senate is a really weird institution in the sense that any one member, if I went to the floor right now and I objected, one senator could bring the United States Senate and hence the entire government to a halt. So you need some kind of unwritten agreement that that is not going to happen. Between 1917 and 1967, filibusters were used less than 50 times, fewer than 50 times. Since Harry Reid has been majority leader over the last 6.5 years, he has had to have cloture votes to end filibusters well over 400 times. Our Republican friends say, well, you know, in the past, Democrats used to do it, and there's some truth to that. But what is the reality now is the Republicans have taken obstructionism and filibusters to an entirely new level.
To hear more of that interview, go to dianereem.org. That's our show for this week. Do let us know what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Leave us a voicemail. The number 202-854-8851, or send us an email to drpodcast@wamu.org. I'll be off for the next 2 weeks. I'll be in Cuba, my second visit there, and I can't wait. My longtime dear friend and NPR colleague Tom Gelton will be hosting the show. He'll be terrific. Our theme music was composed by Cliff Harton and comes to us courtesy of the Capitol Soundtrack Project here at WAMU. The show is produced by Sandra Baker and Rebecca Kaufman. I'm Diane Rehm, and thanks for listening.